It's about that time. I'll give it a start. Good evening and welcome, everyone, to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rick.
I'll start again. Good evening and welcome, everyone, to the Simple Actions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Rick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Rick.
Hi, Rick.
For those who would care to join us, let us open the meeting with the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen.
The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance this evening. These premises are non-smoking. Our group is welcome to use this room, the restrooms, and the restrooms exclusively, which are just across the main foyer and up a small flight of steps just to the right. At this time, please silence your cell phones. Also, we respectfully ask that those present please refrain from unnecessary moving around the room. This will keep distractions and disturbances to a minimum and allow everyone to listen uninterrupted, just in case there are some listening. This group practices the spiritual foundations of anonymity, singleness of purpose, and effective sponsorship. As a group, we believe that Alcoholics Anonymous provides alcoholics with a set of clear directions on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of simple actions. These actions are contained in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the purpose of this meeting to carry that clear message and to focus on precisely how to recover from the illness of alcoholism on the basis of AA's simple actions. I will now read the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not aligned with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open big book step study. As a group, we recognize the power of one alcoholic identifying with another alcoholic, sharing their experience, strength, and hope from the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. We encourage you to engage in the conversation and ask questions after the meeting pertaining to the step discussed tonight. This evening, we are discussing step number 3. Sorry for brief. Sorry, I had a page out. Let's see. Thank you.
I took it.
That's okay. I'm back now. Sorry for the brief interlude. Okay, this evening we are discussing step number 3, and I'd like to introduce our guest tonight. We have Mark and Sammy down from Richmond. They're a couple, and they work together in a women's group home up in Richmond and support the effort to bring women to sobriety. They made they have made quite a contribution in the Richmond area, and we can't wait to partake of their wisdom, their experience, strength, and hope tonight. Okay, I'll continue on. Let's see. All right, we're going to start step 3. Let's see. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. Okay, on page 60 is where we're going to start our discussion. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and C, that God could and would if He were sought. Okay, who's ready to start?
Hi, my name is Mark Griffin. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Mark.
I have to tell you that it says in here that these were 3 pertinent ideas that were made clear. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of years before it became clear to me that my life was unmanageable. I came into AA, and I knew that if I wanted to stay alive, I had to stay sober, and this is where staying sober happened. So I did what I was told. But unfortunately for me, I had this idea in the back of my mind that I could still run my life okay. You know, I had some consequences. The IRS was waiting for me to make financial amends years before I ever got here. and then the state, of course, wanted theirs, and every municipality in which I had resided over the previous 20 years were all in line for some kind of money. And I had some unmanageability there, but you could not convince me that my life was unmanageable. I had my own business, had a business card that told you just how great I was. I had a nice house on a golf course. I had a wife, and I thought that was a thing you had to have back then. I had my car, my truck, and the boat, and I thought everything I needed to show you that I was a good and decent human being was sitting right there. And if I could manage that, then my life wasn't unmanageable. And interestingly enough, my higher power, who laughs when I make plans, managed in the space of a week to take me from having all of that to being unemployed and living in an unfinished attic. I had as my life's possessions at that point to show for all of my work, my golf clubs, a color TV, and a dog. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It was the turning point in my sobriety, because for the first time in my life, there was nothing between God and me. I didn't have all the stuff. I had nothing but time and what became an open heart for the program to work. I found this once again in the Big Book when I was alone in that room pondering what I was going to do with the rest of my life, because we're alcoholics and we're not concerned about tomorrow, we're concerned about 30 years from now. And I had underlined all of this when I was in treatment, but when I was in treatment, I went through and underlined everything I thought I needed to know to get out of treatment. So my Big Book looked like I was really heavily involved in it, and actually it was just a dodge on my part as an active alcoholic to prove that the psychiatrist who locked me away wrote down that I was goal-focused and delusional, and I was goal-focused and delusional up to the point where I lost everything that I owned. And it made a tremendous difference in my life having to start from scratch. I became open to the idea that there was a power greater than me who could restore me to sanity, and my life started to turn from there. So, pass to Sammy.
Okay. I'm Sammy. I'm an alcoholic. Excuse my voice. I've had the flu, so everything's gone except for the voice is just staying gone. My sobriety date is September 1st, 1989, and I got sober. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous from treatment, and I got a sponsor immediately. Well, they told me I had a week to get one, so on the seventh day, you know, I got one. But what was good for me and from at the beginning is I was ready. I had all this enthusiasm. I wanted it so bad. So when I got with this sponsor and we sat down and were reading this, I did not know I was an alcoholic when I got here. I just thought I was mentally ill. So every time someone talked about this, if some can identify, you'll know exactly what I'm talking about. When they gave me that description of the alcoholic, the first thing I said is, oh my God, I'm so glad it's not my fault, because everything's always been my fault. And it immediately told me that there was a solution. You know, immediately it told me that. But when I first got here, everything was so far over my head. You know, that word powerless, like, what is that? I was always powerful. You know, I was running my life, I was doing it. And so things were over my head, but my sponsor said it to me this way. She just broke it down real simple, that I'm powerless over alcohol two ways. mentally and physically. Okay, and that gave me an out. I like that idea. You know, I thought everybody was saying things and it was just too much. Y'all were taking this way too seriously. And then she made me look at the fact that how my life was unmanageable. And at that time, it was my measly little life, but it was mine. It's all I had. And at that point, I was so sick of me that that's what made me willing to at least hear this. So my unmanageability at that point, like I had lost my family, I lost every job, I became an alone drinker. I was so alone for years. I didn't have anybody in my life for years. I was a loner. And so, you know, when she said, Sammy, that's not normal, you know, and, you know, to me, I don't know what normal is, and, you know, but so I started to understand that my life was unmanageable, because if you work with newcomers and if you're new, what you have is your normal way of life, and it's okay. I mean, it's, you know, you're not getting exactly what you want, but it's yours. So I had to look at it from an entirely different angle and look at my life on the unmanageability in order for me to get understand about the powerless. But she said, if you are truly powerless over your body and your mind, you better tap into a power that's going to help you. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how to do that. I mean, I don't have a God. You know, I was one of those that came in neither good nor bad, but didn't have one. But I had to find a power that's going to restore me to sanity. And at that time, I didn't even know if I was ever sane in my life. I don't ever remember being an honest person. I don't ever remember me not being fearless. I was always so fearful. So that unmanageability started to hit in and started to make me realize that I need to get this higher power, but how was I to do that? And that's what this is about. And that God could and would if he were sought. Now, I started doing things that I didn't really want to do, but also I didn't know why I was doing it. I started saying from the very beginning, my sponsor had me practice, that God either is or he isn't. God either is or he isn't. I'd come home frantic from, you know, if I missed a stoplight or something, and I'd be frantic over everything. And she goes, didn't we say that God is today? And I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot. You know, because I would forget every minute of the day. But that was the start for me at this point. You know, I realized that I'm very unmanageable, you know, and I'm freaking out over everything. You know, I'm not stable. I couldn't even get a job. I had to get a get well job and do things like that in order for me to get that sanity. So.
Okay. Thank you, Sam. I'm going to pick back up on page 60 at the paragraph which begins, being convinced. We were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. Just what do we do, and what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody. Even though our motives are good, most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Is forever. So let me start back in to get that. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. Is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballot, the scenery, the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. Mark?
being convinced we were at step three. That was an interesting point in my life, finally being convinced that I was at step three, because it's where AA started to work in my life. But I can tell you that my life was run on self-will, and it was run on self-will until I'd been sober for a number of years. I was raised in a household by a loving man who was born in 1917, lived through the Depression, educated himself, fought in World War II, held on to everything that he got, made every nickel that he could, saved every penny that he could, did everything he could for his family, and he did it all by self-will. And I was taught that that self-will is exactly what I needed to make my life run properly. So that's what I thought when I got here. I thought self-will was going to cure me from drinking. I stood in the bathroom April 2nd of 1993 and looked in the mirror and said, "That's it, I'm through, I quit drinking." And I thought that's all I had to do. The next day I had a grand mal seizure. My ex-wife claims that I tried to kill her. I have no idea. I wasn't there for any of it. I just apparently beat my head into the floor for quite a long time and went and fell asleep on the couch. And then some policemen came and brought an ambulance that took me to the hospital. Self-will wasn't working. And while I was there in that hospital, my family doctor came and visited me in the ER. And he asked me point blank, "Just how much do you really drink?" And I told him, and it was the first time I'd ever told anybody how much I drank, because frankly I didn't think it was anybody's business. And I got a great sense of relief from that. But my self-will is so strong that a few minutes later they backed my head into a CAT scan to see if there were any problems there that caused a seizure. And I remember thinking, maybe I'll have a brain tumor and I can still drink. Exactly. And that's where I was. Self-will was absolutely embedded in everything that I did, and I thought I had the self-will to get out of treatment. Actually, all I needed was my insurance to quit paying, and I got out of treatment instantaneously. They'll say goodbye to you in a second if the money's not coming in. And I went home and I started a life of recovery. And what I learned about self-will very quickly was I went to a meeting the night I got out of treatment and picked up a white chip and got a sponsor, all in the same meeting. I asked a complete stranger just to be my sponsor because they told me I needed to get one. I wouldn't recommend excuse me, picking up a sponsor the way I picked one, because I didn't pick the nicest man in the room. He did not brook any whining from me. He would not like any negative talk from me. Many a time back then, he would offer me $5 and the opportunity to go get drunk if all I was going to do was stand around and cry. And I thought that what he meant was I had to be stronger about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I had to have more force into it, that I had to have more control over it. And what he was really telling me is I needed to get out of self. And that's what we talked about when I started to do the third step for the first time, was the whole idea wasn't just turning my will over to God, it was getting out of self. It was finding a way to live in a world that wasn't run by my misconceptions and my bad thinking and my egotistical thinking. Because you can mix up these qualities that they talked about in the alcoholic. You can be a very patient, egotistical human being. I know, because I was. And I found that as I started to take seriously the idea of staying sober and turning my will and my life over to the care of God, a great thing happened, and it happened kind of unknowingly. And that is, when I turned my will over, I turned over all my character defects. And I turned over all of my problems. I didn't realize it when I did it the first time that that's exactly what was happening. That I wasn't just giving God my life, that I was giving him everything. And I started to get picky about what I wanted to give him. You can have this God, but you can't have that. And my sponsor made it clear to me that I should be happy that there was a God that would take my life, because it wasn't really worth anything at that point. And so I made a concerted effort to turn my entire life over to the care of God, and I didn't realize at the time that I got relief from the problems that I had in my life, not because I'd found some magic key, but rather because I'd turned all of those problems over to the care of God. And I involuntarily had made myself open for a solution to come into my life by turning my will over to the care of God as I understood him. And in doing so, I discovered, well, frankly, I'm not interested in being an actor at all, much less running the play, but to use another metaphor, I would be willing to be any player on the football team. I don't have to be the quarterback. I don't have to be the coach. Today, it's satisfying for me just to be a part of the process.
Thanks, Mark. At the beginning of this, it says, just what do we mean by that and just what do we do, which was really good for me because I had no idea what to do, none. So I came in there very childlike, you know, and wanting to know what's going on. It says the first requirement, so there are requirements, you know. If you don't think there are, there's a few of them in the book. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And my sponsor made me look at what does success mean to you? What does success mean? For me, I grew up, and Jewishness doesn't have anything to do with this, but I grew up Jewish, and I always was brought up believing that money, property, and prestige was going to make me very successful. And I failed very much so at that. And but that's what my thinking was. Now, that was 38 years of thinking that way. So you got to remember that when we come in here, we're bringing a lot of years into my personality that had formed. And it says, so today, of course, it means something different to me. You know, being comfortable in my own skin. Being able to look at someone and talk to them means so much to me, not being afraid. That is so successful to me. I am a success. But it says when I'm running on the old ideas of the success that I had, the self-will, it says right here, on that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though we think our motives are good. So when that came up all the time, when I was doing that self-will, and I was always in collision with somebody, I was such a troublemaker when I got here. I wanted to be the best. I wanted to have the first one to be in my group to have a spiritual awakening. You know, very competitive, and I wanted all these things. And my sponsor would say, whose will is this? Whenever you're in collision with something or somebody, you're in self-will. That's a hard statement, isn't it? Think about it. Because I was always in collision with somebody. Well, today I don't want that in my life. I really don't. He talked about being the actor. I like how it talks about the varied traits in this book, because I was all those things. I used to think I was a pretty decent person. You know, and I was only manipulating to get what I wanted. What was the big deal? You know, and then I would have to run and hide, move to another city. That was me. My sponsees will say, what's the difference? I mean, how do you know when you're in self-will? Well, this explains it very well. It's very specific, as you said. It's very precise, and it's exactly what I needed to hear. And when you think about that, it's like, gosh, I'm doomed. I'm always in collision. But my life has changed, you know, and it didn't take overnight, but I had someone pointing that out to me, God's will or self-will. Self-will cannot overcome God's will. You have to have God to overcome. Okay.
Thank you, Sid.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm going to pick back up at the very next paragraph on page 61. with what usually happens. Okay. The show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admittedly, he may be somewhat at fault. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault. He is sure that other people were more to blame, though. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker? Even when trying to be kind, is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only he manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of his to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And does not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Mark?
I was minding my own business about 15 years ago, and one afternoon my sponsor called me up and said, I have a special job for you. And I'm a gullible soul, so I just said, what? And he said, you're going to be the chairman of the state convention. And I thought that probably was like hanging an albatross around my neck. I just couldn't imagine getting alcoholics to do exactly what they should do when they're supposed to do it. It just didn't seem possible to me. And I didn't want the responsibility of trying to get people to do, and I will tell you that I'm innately lazy. I didn't want to do their jobs for them either. and so I prayed quite a bit about it after I told him I'd do it, because there's no saying no to my sponsor. And I met with the committee the next week, and I will tell you, it was one of the truly satisfying experiences I've had as an adult in working with other people trying to accomplish a task. Everybody, without any pressure from me, did exactly what they were supposed to do. Everything, the show came off well, to quote the big book. It was a great convention. We actually ran it well enough so that we ended up returning money to the state rather than costing them money. And I discovered that there's a unique rule of thumb when it comes to doing anything in life, especially in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is, I'm responsible for one person and one person only. And my responsibility, and when it comes to being part of the show, is a very simple, to be of service where I can. The whole idea of getting out of self came around to me when I realized that being the chairman didn't have anything to do with lofty titles or important positions. What it had to do with was making sure that the alcoholics of the state of Virginia had a convention they could go to, a conference they could go to, that was fulfilling and well done. And we did that. And I tell you that the longer I stayed in this program and the longer that I worked the steps and the longer I had my sponsor, and I've had the same sponsor for 21 years now, almost 21 years, the idea of self-pity is not allowed. I am tempted to wallow in self-pity on occasion. Even my wife will tell me if I'm upset about something that I get a day to be upset. I better be over it by tomorrow. Self-pity is a poison. It's really just another form of pride. And what I've discovered in working the third step is that my pride is the biggest stumbling block that I have to being a part of anything that is good and enriching in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my pride comes in many different forms. It is intellectual, it is egotistical, it is self-pitying. It doesn't make any difference, whatever the need is. I've got this pride deal going on that I have to keep in check constantly, because deep down inside, I'm an alcoholic who still wants to be the head of the deal. When I really worked the third step for the first time, I finally discovered what the deal was. And the deal was for me to have a growing relationship with a power greater than myself. And that power that I call God was going to change my life, not just once and all, but every day. Every day that I chose to be a part of that, I would be a different person. I would grow a little bit. I would learn a little bit. I would be open to other people telling me things that made an impact in my life. And I've discovered that the power of the third step for me, as far as the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world, is I don't have to wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world. I've already got it. I discovered that the big G word made all the difference when it comes to the third step, and that is gratitude. When I found gratitude, I found a way to happiness that has been unchanging since I've made a decision to be grateful. Now, Thomas Merton, who's one of my favorite Trappist monks, wrote a lot of incredibly prescient things, once said that you're either grateful or you're ungrateful, but there's no gray area in between. And as I go through my day, I remember that. I remember that. If I can be grateful for sitting here, for being with you people, for having the opportunity to share about the third step, I don't think about the potential traffic going back and the fact that it's going to be, you know, midnight before I see home again and on and on. I am grateful for the idea that somebody thought enough for me to come down here and spend time with you folks. And I've discovered that if I can find some gratitude every day, then my third step is a reality every day.
Thanks, Mark. This part of the third step, the thing that hit me the most, of course it would, is I was a producer of confusion rather than harmony. And I think that was my entire life. You know, I was always a producer of confusion. And I would always go, what? I mean, what's the big deal? You know, I was really like that. And then moved to another city to get out of it. And I did do that a lot. But like Mark had said about the self-pitying, I was very much into that. And I had a very kind sponsor who really encouraged me a lot. I mean a lot. Because I needed a lot of encouragement. I was always back into that self-pity. You know, my family hates me. You know, I don't fit. You know, I'm fat. You know, I don't care what it is. I was just constantly into that. And what happened is I'm so glad I had someone really there all the time to make me see the other side, to make me be grateful, you know, to find the joy that, you know, that I had at that moment. And, you know, this is my experience. I needed that every day. I would read a meditational every morning with my sponsor. And I would be floating. My head was in the clouds. Within 5 minutes, I was chiseled away. You know, I was like this, you know. And what happened was over time, and I don't know when this happened. I don't know when it went from here to here. And I think, I know that I practiced a lot. I practiced God. I practiced turning my will. I don't want this anymore. And I really didn't. I didn't want Sammy anymore. I was sick of her. And I would do it. It wasn't fast enough, you know, for me. But I kept doing it. Every night, my sponsor would say, go right to God. And I'm like, oh, it's just so stupid, you know. And I would go right to God. Until one day, he was in my heart, you know. And I didn't want that confusion anymore. You know, and I'm telling, and if you're new here, I promise those things can happen for you too. You know, because it's not a way to live. It isn't. I'm a better person at work. I'm a good wife. I had to practice that too. it's the key, practice. But I have friends today. It's in all my affairs, you know, practicing these spiritual principles. And a principle, the basic of a principle is just the truth. That's what a principle is, the truth. And see, that's what I had to learn. I had to learn the truth, and that was going to set me free from the confusion. And I've always wanted that, always.
Okay. Thank you, Sammy.
You're welcome.
Okay, we're going to pick up on page 62 with the paragraph that begins, so our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will or unriot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must rid ourselves of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we have reduced our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. Mark?
I had moral and philosophical convictions galore. I had them because I thought that they were something you should have. Not that they made a tremendous impact in my life. I didn't really care to the idea of going to college, but when my father convinced me to, I managed to major in philosophy to kind of guarantee that I never got a job for anything that I learned in college. But it was an interesting major. It is important to me, the paragraph just before that says selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. That was the one sentence in this book that reached out and just slapped me into awareness of what was going on. I had to understand that I was selfish and self-centered, regardless of what my altruistic intentions seemed to be. There was selfishness and self-centeredness there. I was raised in the Presbyterian Church. I was preaching in that church when I was 14, 15 years old. I was the youngest ordained deacon in the history of the church. Taught Sunday school, was assistant treasurer of the church. None of that managed to get in the way of my finding a beer. I can tell you, I thought that there was this church life, and then there was drinking whenever I could get alcohol when I was a teenager, and then when I became old enough to buy beer, I became a daily drinker. Why was I a daily drinker at the age of 17? Well, the reason why is because I was selfish and self-centered. I didn't care what you thought about me. I didn't care what you knew about me. I didn't care anything about you unless it had an impact on how I managed to live my life. I firmly believed that I was the center of the universe, and I didn't care about what happened to these little planets that bumped into me every now and then. And I lived my life that way up until the time that I got sober. And when I got sober, I was still selfish and self-centered. My first wife and I met in a bar. She drank like I did. Couldn't drink as much as I did, which was kind of nice because she'd pass out and give me a couple hours of peace every night, but our relationship was based on selfish and self-centered ambitions, and it did exactly what that relationship was destined to do. When I got sober, and ultimately she didn't, we parted company. And I didn't, it dawned on me for a second that I had anything... any hand in that had selfishness and self-centeredness written all over it. What's so selfish about wanting good in your life? What's so selfish about wanting some things in your life? What's so selfish about wanting to be happy? Well, actually, those aren't things that you should aspire to. They should be the result of right behavior. And that's what I've discovered, is if I know that I'm selfish and self-centered and do what I have to do to live life on those terms, it's only God that can take me away from that. It's only God that can let me live a productive life in spite of my alcoholic selfishness and self-centeredness. And what I've discovered as I go through this deal is that I have to work the third step all the time. It's not a one-time deal for me. I work the third step daily sometimes. And it's not that way with the other steps. I've worked a very thorough fourth step and fifth step and never felt compelled to do another one. The tenth step was there for me to take care of things that happened and came through. But it never dawned on me that that third step didn't just kind of automatically run with me all the time, that I didn't have to invent a place in my mind to go every day to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Because the day I don't is the day I'm selfish and self-centered. It's the day that I make sure that what I want is the most important thing in my life. And my wants are not in any way aligned with what God's plans are for me. I've discovered this the hard way. It really came home to roost to me as just an everyday human being trying to live life on life's terms. When Sammy and I owned a restaurant, I discovered that my selfish desires to see that restaurant succeed were going to drive us into the ground. I had to be open to the idea of learning from other people and simply doing the job in front of me every day. And that's what I do today. I get up and I figure out what my task is today. If my task is to meet a new woman to move into a recovery house, that's what I do. And I don't put any projections on it. I don't put any expectations on it. I just let it happen. And it happens in God's time and in God's way. And it works out. It almost always works out for the best. Expectations are disasters. In my life, if I have expectations, what I have is an unwillingness to see God's will come true in my life. And if I have expectations, what I've discovered is I have no serenity, because I put all my energy into being selfish and self-centered about my expectations and trying to get exactly what I want. And so I have discovered that expectations are inversely related to serenity. I would rather have serenity than expectations. And the only way that I can get out of this expectation business is to make sure that I'm not the one running my life every day.
Thanks, Mark. Wow. I wish I had that. Well, for me, when it says, so our troubles of our own making, I didn't like that at all. I'm go back to my personality. I don't want it to be my fault. It goes back to, you know, he didn't care about what people thought about him. I cared what everybody thought about me and how it looked and how I sounded. I cared so much about that it drove me crazy, you know. And I've had to learn to that extreme self will run riot. You know, it's such a perfect line for me because I was extreme about everything. I'm very dramatic, you know, and so, you know, it sounds so great how he puts it, but my life has changed in those areas, very much so. I still will be surprised at things. You know, my sponsor says, you know, you'll be, you know, she's not amazed anymore, you know, she's just not amazed. I still get amazed, you know, at some of the things. But I've learned, I think, the best thing when it comes to selfishness and self-centeredness, when it says that we must be rid of this or else. I mean, that's pretty powerful, or else. Are you threatening me? You know? But it's powerful. Because I know from my actions what it's done to me, and it's almost killed me in sobriety. It's almost killed me. And that's why today I would love to be perfect on this and turn it over and, you know, but today I've learned to keep my mouth shut. I think that's the most spiritual thing that I can do is keep my mouth shut and let things, you know, lie where they are. And I can remember more when I do that because it, my natural instinct, you know, the word abandon in the big book, if you look it up, it means to surrender to my natural impulse. That's what abandon. So I have to abandon myself. I have to surrender my natural impulse, which is to hate, you know, to gossip, to, you know, character assassinate. You know, that's my aren't I a lovely person? In the cups of my alcoholism. Those are my natural instincts. And today what I've done, you know, through God and through you people and through my sponsor, is I've learned to, besides keep calm, keep quiet, and let some new, as it says in the big book, a new attitude, a new set of conceptions come in. Because that's what I needed. I needed those things to come in. Because I wasn't kind. I wasn't considerate. You know, I had to learn. That's why it says we had to fully learn to concede to our innermost self. I didn't just get it. I had to learn to concede to these things. And over time, it's happened.
Thank you, Sam.
You're welcome.
Okay, I'm going to pick back up on page 62 at the paragraph. This is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. Mark?
He is the principal and we are his agents. I have no idea what he thought when he made me an agent. I wonder if he second-guessed himself on that one. I haven't finished with playing God, I will tell you, but I understand nowadays when things start to fall to pieces why they do. And the reason why is because I've managed to take matters back into my own greedy little hands. And when I get a hold of something, there'll be claw marks on it before you get it back. I don't give them up lightly. I really think that this idea that our troubles are of our own making is kind of the fundamental basis on which I have to change my life. I woke up one day alone in that unfinished attic, and I realized that I could not continue to run my life. I mean, I had been working for 25, 30 years, and everything that I had managed to acquire was gone. Every title that I thought was important was gone. Everything that I thought was important was gone. And it was all my doing. I'm sure that all of that stuff was good to have, and I know it is because a lot of it came back to me when I changed my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him. When he became the director of my life became just a little more manageable, but it wasn't manageable by me. And I started to slowly, slowly, slowly advance in the idea that I could be of use to other people. And an interesting thing happened at that point. Thinking that A, I would never get married again, and B, that I would probably never enjoy the prosperity that I enjoyed before again, because it seemed to me like this whole thing was just poverty written all over it. I mean, I just didn't see that there was a way that I was ever going to enjoy the things that I had. And things started to happen. I mean, and things happened in the funniest way. Little things would happen. I, I met Sammy. She took me out to a golf tournament and beat me. There went my ego. And then she ran over my foot with a golf cart. And there but she took me to, this was, I guess, 17 years ago. She took me to Serenity Weekend. I'd never been to a conference before. And of course, with Sammy, you sit on the front row or you don't sit at all. And I'm a back row Presbyterian at heart. So so we sat up there, and an interesting thing happened. They had a 50-50 raffle that weekend, and I won it. And I felt like I was the most unlikely candidate to win several hundred dollars, but I didn't turn it down. And then a gentleman named Tom I spoke, and he changed the way I thought about Alcoholics Anonymous for the rest of my life. All of this happened because I was willing to try something new. And that is kind of the key to me growing at all in Alcoholics Anonymous, is to be willing to try something new. Personally, I think change is a horrible thing. I hate change. I would be happy if everybody had one set of clothes, and we wouldn't change those either. But the fact of the matter is that change goes on around me all the time, and it's part of this play that I'm a part of now. And how it affects me is very simple. I have to be absolutely on my best ability, which is not good, to be open to the idea of change. And because God has different ways he plans on using me, I've discovered. Sometimes it's in AA, sometimes it's out of AA. I've been taking a Bible study to a prison for 13 years. I never intended to do that, I can tell you. A guy walked into my restaurant one afternoon, sat down, and invited me to do it, and I've been doing it since then. And it's a way, one night of the week, that I get out of myself and I do something for another human being. And interestingly enough, in my experience in women's prison, there's nearly everybody in there has a problem with alcohol or drugs, or did when they got arrested and sent to prison. So my AA is always on tap to be of use to these women, even though I'm not in an AA environment. And that's one of the many ways that I've discovered I can be of use to other people. God gave me a kit of tools. And one of those tools is my past. And he made it useful for me. And that makes me happy that I do not have to regret the past or shut the door on it. What I have to do is I have to be willing to take those episodes in my life that I'm not particularly proud of or particularly happy about and use them to help other people. And that way I stay a part of this grand director's plot without attempting to take control myself. Sammy.
Thank you. I love the big book, and I think it flows really well. At this point, when it talks about this is the how am I of it, first we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. He is now, Bill Wilson, when he was writing this, was building this arch to freedom. You know, it was, if you know, on page 12 in Bill's story, it talks about willingness is the foundation of this arch. You know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had that willingness. It was solid because I was really, really ready. I was willing to do anything. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I was willing. And then when I got to the second step, and you, we all know what a cornerstone of a building is. You go outside and you see 1951 on this, you know, the cornerstone to this arch, you know, is the belief stone. And I know this from myself, that we just don't come in here and get faith. You just don't. You have to come to believe first. Even if you came in with the faith already, somewhere along the line you had to come to believe that. And so that cornerstone was fixed in place because I did believe. I believed it. I felt it. I really felt it. And then it was explained to me that the keystone was that middle piece in the arch which held everything together. That's what holds it up. So that's what God is to me. He holds, besides me up, he holds you up. And that's, for me, it's the most important thing in my life today. You know, I remember when my sponsor used to go like this, and she goes, AA and God are right here. And what you do is you take your job and you add that to this. You add it to AA and God. You add the husband, you add in there. But those are the center. That is the keystone of my life. That's holding me together. I don't believe that anymore. I know it. And so I, you know, that keystone is so important to me. It's built that arch that I have been able to walk to freedom. So.
Thank you, Sammy.
You're welcome.
All right, on to the next this paragraph on page 63.
We have this time.
It's 10:56.
Oh, it is 10:50. Sorry.
I didn't realize.
Skip ahead, and I lost track of time. So let's, I was trying to run it, I guess. I'm going to pass the seventh tradition basket, and so I'm going to read the green cord in conjunction with that. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover the group's rent and other expenditures, the seventh tradition is essentially at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local offices, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free from outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help alcoholics who still suffer. The amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world. Okay, as the baskets are going around, are there any announcements, AA-related announcements tonight? Yes.
I'm Sally, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey.
On Saturday, February 22nd, Saturday Morning Brunch Bunch, Virginia Beach, is doing a workshop with District 23 on the importance of a home group. It's going to be from 11 to 1. There'll be four speakers on the panel. We'll have lunch and fellowship. Saturday, February 22nd. Thanks.
Thanks.
Lydia.
Good evening. My name is Lydia, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
On March 13th at 5:30, 49th Street Living Sober is having a speaker and a kid for no reason.
Thank you. Any other? Yes.
Guy.
So there's a new meeting starting in Virginia Beach geared towards young people on Tuesdays at 7 p.m. at Holland Road Baptist Church, which is 4881 Euclid. It's in the hilltop area of Virginia Beach. First meeting starts on, Holland Road, I don't know where that is actually. But it's February 18th, it's the first meeting.
Yes, in the back.
Hi, I'm Katie, I'm an alcoholic.
Katie.
The Virginia State Young People's Conference of AA is going to be at the end of May, the last weekend into June there, at the oceanfront in the Wyndham. But as we're kind of getting prepared for that, we're going to be having some events, so we'll be announcing them throughout the area. The first is going to be this coming Saturday night, February 15th. We're having a speaker or a meeting. And then a dance right after that in Williamsburg at the Triangle Stepping Stones Sober Club. So if you would like more information about that, please come see me after the meeting. The second one is March 22nd. We're going to be having a sponsorship workshop in from 11 to 1 at the Gathering United Methodist Church in Virginia Beach. If you want more information on that, please come to the
Thank you. Any other announcements? Graham?
Yep, this home group on April the 17th, is that right?
21st?
The 21st, on April the 21st in this room, we're having Tom Ine to come and speak, and there'll be a potluck, free food at 6 o'clock, and Tom's going to speak at 7. Everybody's welcome.
Thank you, Graham. Any other announcements? All right, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. All home group members, please raise their hand.
Strong.
Okay. The literature our literature is available over here at the literature table. Please see me or any of the home group members after the meeting if you have questions or wish to purchase some of the material or what's free and what's not. Sponsorship questions. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you to do not delay. Would anyone willing to be a sponsor, please raise their hands. Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, you're all invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on the step discussed tonight at the meeting after the meeting. All are welcome to attend at the Plaza del Sol, a few blocks down, right before the railroad tracks at the corner of Colonial, the main street out here, and 22nd, and it's Plaza del Sol. I think it's extraordinary. The cuisine is probably the best Mexican cuisine north of the border. So y'all going to be able to join us tonight? Or
no, we have 2.5 hour trip back.
Yes, I understand you are on the west side of Richmond, and that is quite a commute. Thank y'all.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, and we're looking for a volunteer. Yes, any other questions? We're looking for a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164. Yes, please.
I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Brian.
Our book is meant to be suggestive only. You realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who's still sick. The answers will come. If your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road to happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you, Brian. All right, we're going to close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer. If you all stand and join hands.
I love how we're not organized.
I love it.
It's not possible.
It's the first circle we've made.
Brian, would you be happy enough to take us out with the Lord's Prayer?
Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory.